Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar Series, where great professors teach you. My name is Henry Strozier, and I'll be your host. Today we begin a course entitled Heavens Above, Stars, Constellations, and the Sky. Your professor is James B. Kaler, a professor emeritus at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He received his A.B. in astronomy from the University of Michigan in 1960 and his Ph.D. from the University of California, Los Angeles in 1964. He has been at Illinois ever since. His research area, in which he has published over 120 papers, involves dying stars, specifically the graceful shells and rings of gas ejected in stellar death called planetary nebulae. He has held both Fulbright and Guggenheim fellowships and is currently president of the board of directors of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. For more information on this course, please visit its webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin Heavens Above, Stars, Constellations, and the Sky. Lecture 1. Sky and Stars. And now, Professor Kaler.
I've been in love with the sky all my life. The daytime sky of the sun and the blue sky, the blue vault over our heads, and the nighttime sky of the stars. I fell in love with the stars when I first looked up, when I was 8 years old, and saw an orange star, and wondered at the color, and tried to find out what it was, and began to look around the sky at the other stars, eventually trying to learn the constellations, tried to learn their names, and fell in love more and more with the wonder of the whole thing. It led me to early books on astronomy. It led me, finally, to my first telescope, where I could find some of the first celestial objects. It led me to undergraduate school, and it led me to my professional career, all from looking up at a beautiful orange star I now know by Arcturus, the brightest star of the northern sky. You ever go outside at night, admire the stars, and wonder what they are and what stories they have to tell? Ever thought you'd like to understand what they are, know the names of the stars, know the patterns, know the constellations, know where they rise and set, know the Big Dipper, and why the Big Dipper isn't really a constellation? It's an informal pattern. You know why the Big Dipper doesn't rise or set? You ever wonder why you can't see the Southern Cross? Here we're going to find out the meanings of the celestial figures, where they came from, why we still use them today, thousands of years after the first ones were invented. This course is designed to look at the sky and to look at the constellations, see where they came from. We're going to look at all the constellations from the ancient ones through the modern ones, through the dead ones, through the funny ones, and we're going to wind the whole thing up by looking at the Milky Way. And we're going to start by looking at what stars really are. We're going to have to use the power of the imagination a lot here. There's no blackboard. There's no figures. There's no drawings. So sort of close your mind's eyes and open it up again to the sky and the stars. Go out and stand in an open field, the blue sky over your head. It looks like a huge inverted bowl. It's an imaginary celestial sphere that wraps all around you. It's imaginary. It's not real. It's the blue sky. It's the dome of the dark sky at night. Everything you see in the sky, the sun, moon, and stars, the constellation pattern seem to lie on this great celestial sphere, which isn't really there. It's just an illusion, but pretend it is. Here we're going to look first, however, not at the constellations so much, but at the background. We have to get the sky dark first. Watch the sun set. And then we'll explore something of the true natures of the heavens and of the stars. We have to deal with light before anything else. Fastest thing we know, 186,000 miles per second, 300,000 kilometers per second, from here to the moon in a second and a half. From here to the most distant planet in 4 hours. From here to the sun in 8 minutes. Incredibly fast. It's the fastest thing possible. We see a tiny fraction of the light that nature gives us. It's called the visual spectrum, the array, from red through violet. One octave of an immense array of electromagnetic radiation. Light is actually a flow of electricity and magnetism going through the cosmos, not going through anything, not going through a medium, but simply vibrating past you. It also acts as a particle. It's a wave and a particle at the same time. Off the red end of the spectrum lies the infrared, which you can't see. The energies are too low to excite the eye. Beyond that lies the radio. Shorter than the violet lies the ultraviolet from the burning rays of the sun. Below the ultraviolet is the X-ray. Below that is the gamma ray. These radiations are burning. They're deadly. But right in the middle is our visual spectrum where we can see the stars. Ever wonder why the sky is blue? It's because of sunlight scattering off molecules in the Earth's atmosphere. Light is characterized by a wave, and it's an odd sort of thing. It's not just a wave, it's a particle at the same time. This is not something that you can really imagine. It's in the mathematics of it. The particle of light is called the photon. You can think of it as a particle that sort of carries a wave along with it. Red light has the longest wavelength, somewhere around 1/100,000th of a centimeter or so, and the violet light has the shortest wavelength. Air scatters light. As sunlight passes through the Earth's atmosphere, the violet light is scattered out far more than the red light. The red light gets through just fine, and as we go down toward shorter wavelengths, the scattering efficiency gets greater and greater. By the time we get to blue, a good fraction of the sunlight is scattered out, so when you look off into the distance at the blue sky, you're really seeing the blue component of sunlight. It would turn violet, except there's not a lot of violet in sunlight, and the eye is not terribly sensitive to violet, so the sky turns blue, and it turns all shades of pretty blue. From the bluest is at an angle of about 90 degrees from the sun. Go on, take a look at it. It'll be dark blue overhead, opposite the sun, and then down toward the horizon it gets to be a light blue. It depends an awful lot on the angle of the sun and how high the sun is up in the sky. We know the Earth is round, but, you know, when you stand out in a field somewhere, it looks almost flat, and use your imagination again and sort of pretend it is. The air lies as a blanket over our heads, and as the sun begins to set, the sunlight has to go through more and more air, and more blue light is scattered out of sunlight, and that begins to turn the sun a bit on the reddish side, and the farther down the sun gets, the redder the sun appears to be, until on a perfect evening out in the flat countryside, the sun begins to turn almost a magenta color. Then the sunlight scattering and reflecting off the clouds turns it into a beautiful reddish sunset. And as the sun sets, turn off in the other direction to the east, and you can watch a gray band rising in the east. The Earth's shadow projected out onto the sky. We talk of nightfall. But if you look off into the east as the sun sets, you can see night actually rising instead of falling until it sweeps over the heavens and the sky begins to turn dark and the first stars begin to come out. And the darker it gets, the more stars you can see. It's a period called twilight, when sunlight is scattering off the upper part of the Earth's atmosphere. And eventually, when the sun gets down to technically 18 degrees below the horizon, the sky is as dark as it can get, and all the stars come out, and the magic actually begins. Maybe the moon is out. The moon goes around the Earth in about a month. That's where the term month actually comes from. Goes through its phase cycle. The phases are caused by our seeing different parts of the sunlit hemisphere of the moon. When the moon is opposite the sun, it washes out the stars. It's hard to see any, but the moonlight, which is just reflected sunlight, actually turns the sky a beautiful, very, very dark blue. Go take a look. None of this material that we're going to be talking about over the next 14 lectures is abstract. It's all real. You can go out and see it yourselves, and I encourage everybody to do that. Go on out. If you have to drive out into the country to see a dark sky, please do it. We've lost so much with the lights and the artificial lighting and the stores and the street lights. It's worth the drive 50 miles out in the country to stand under a clear sky after twilight is over with, after we've hit the 18-degree limit, and look at the stars, and wait until there's a new moon, when the moon is between us and the sun, there's no moon out, and look at the fabulous number that appear in the sky. It looks as if the number of stars is almost infinite. But actually, you can see, if you have good eyes, and when you had young eyes, perhaps if you're older like me, you can see about 8,000, depending upon how good your eyes are, about 2,000 a night. Now, you're only looking at half the celestial sphere. It's cut in half by the horizon, and you'd think that you should be able to see half of the naked eye stars, about 4,000 a night. But it depends a lot on how the sky is oriented, whether the Milky Way, this band of light around the sky, is up or not. The Earth's atmosphere absorbs starlight. You can't see them very well down toward the horizon. You see more and more as you climb up to the overhead point. So we see actually less than half of them at night. But even so, 2,000, 3,000 perhaps in a given night is a lot. Hard to count them. They start off as very bright. They're all different brightnesses and go down until they just are lost into the blackness of the nighttime sky. We have to characterize how bright the stars are. Brightness measures, or estimates at least, were first done by an ancient Greek astronomer named Hipparchus in the 2nd century B.C. He divided the sky and the stars up into six brightness groups, which we now in English call magnitudes. The brightest stars are first magnitude. The faintest stars the human eye can see are sixth. There are about 20 first magnitude stars, and the fainter you get, the more and more there are of them, until there are hundreds, if not thousands, of sixth magnitude stars. In the 19th century, we quantified the magnitude system. We still use it today, 2,000 years after it was invented, and put it on a mathematical basis. The brightest stars, so-called first magnitude stars, the brightest ones came out to be zeroth magnitude, and the actual brightest one is minus first. Venus comes in at even minus 5, the full moon at minus 12. The sun at minus 27, and that's a star that you should not look at. That will damage your eyes. In any case, we're going to be looking mostly at night. The stars of the Big Dipper, about second magnitude. The North Star is second magnitude. Handle of the Big Dipper is fourth. You sort of get the idea. And we'll talk about magnitudes and brightnesses of stars as we go through all of our beautiful constellation patterns. Not only are they at different brightnesses, but they're at different colors, too. Kind of surprises people to know that stars have colors to them. But go on out in a dark sky and take a look. The colors are subtle. What really jump out at you are the reds. We can find reddish stars like Antares, Betelgeuse, the first star of the bowl of the Big Dipper, the first star of the bowl of the Little Dipper. They're all reddish. They're actually called red giant stars, and we'll take a look in a little while and see where they all came from. The color depends upon the temperature of the star. The hot ones tend to be a little bit on the blue side, the cool ones on the red side. Constellations are imaginary patterns. They're not real. They come from stars that are of all different sizes, ages, temperatures, stars at all different distances. Before we get into the business of the patterns, the artistry of the sky, we really need to look at what stars actually are. They're distant suns, and being distant suns, we have to look at our own sun and see what it's like. Don't go out and look at it. Just imagine it. It's too bright to see. The sun provides all of our warmth, all of our light. We don't pay a lot of attention to it because it's too bright to look at. But with proper filtration, proper instrumentation, it turns out to be an extraordinary body that has immense influences on us that we don't really pay a lot of attention to. It's actually a ball of gas about 1 million miles across, about 100 million miles away from us. Surface temperature is about 6,000 degrees. It gives it kind of a yellowish color, yellow-white, influenced a bit by the Earth's atmosphere. It's really a ball of gas, highly compressed, almost a perfect sphere brought about by its own gravity. The most outstanding characteristic is its incredible luminosity. It's hard to explain. 10 to the 26 watts, that's one followed by 26 zeros. It would take the gross national product of the United States somewhere around 1 million years for your local power company to run the sun for about a second. There's enough energy coming out of the sun in 1 second to run all of the power needs of the world for roughly 1 million years. We just pick up a very tiny amount of it. The sun's a controlled hydrogen bomb. Yeah, that's a little bit scary, isn't it? But it's not going to blow up. The sun can't blow up. We know it's not going to blow up, and we don't just speculate that. We actually know it. There are stars that do blow up, but it's not the sun. The sun is a controlled fusion reactor. As you go into the sun, pretend you can go into the sun. Nobody's ever going to do that. You'd be vaporized in trying. The temperature goes up and the density go up in concert with each other until they reach an astounding nearly 15 million degrees Kelvin. That's the temperature scale above absolute zero on the Celsius scale. 15 million degrees Kelvin at the center, and the density is somewhere around a dozen times that of lead, and it's still a gas because of the high temperature. When you get about three-quarters of the way in, the temperature hits in the millions of degrees, it's possible then for hydrogen atoms, which dominate the sun. The sun is around 90% simple hydrogen, simple protons, and about 10% helium. The hydrogen begins to react, and we turn four hydrogen atoms into one helium atom. And there's a little bit of loss of mass. As Mr. Einstein said in the early part of the 20th century, in the most famous equation probably in existence, E, energy, equals mc squared. Everybody has heard about that. You take a little bit of mass, and by multiplying it by the speed of light squared, which we already know is really a huge number, you produce a spectacular amount of energy. But it's all very controlled. The first reaction, which takes two protons, two hydrogen atoms, and turns them into something called deuterium, a heavier hydrogen atom, is incredibly slow, and that keeps the sun from blowing up. Once you get those two reactions going, the next steps that turn the hydrogen into helium are relatively fast. The sun's 4.5 billion years old. We know that from the radioactive record on Earth. As radioactive elements like uranium and thorium decay and they turn into lead, we can take Earth rocks, we can take moon rocks, we can take meteorites, and we can look at how much lead is there compared to the amount of uranium and thorium that are left. And knowing the rate of decay, we can determine the ages of these bodies, and we come up with 4.5 billion years, almost consistently. And the most remarkable thing about the sun is this extraordinary energy output has been going on for the last 4.5 billion years. There was enough hydrogen in the sun to run the sun for a full 10 billion years from start to finish. The radioactive record shows that we're about halfway through. The sun is a middle-aged star like many of us. It has a youth behind it. It has a good long life yet in front of us. We still have 5 billion years of solar life to enjoy it. Well, even though the sun is pretty stable, it's not entirely stable. It was about 30% fainter when it was born 4.5 billion years ago, and it's actually gradually getting a little bit brighter, and we'll look at the nature of that in a couple of minutes. But that still gives us a couple of billion years, and given the fact that humanity has not been around for even a couple of million, a billion is a really big number. So we've got don't get depressed about it. We've got a long time left to us to enjoy our beautiful, beautiful Earth, which is truly a product of the sun. If you think the sun is spectacular, then start looking at some of the other stars. Let's look at some of the characteristics. There are stars, dead stars, that are about the size of Manhattan. There are stars that are about the size of the orbits of the outer planets. There are stars that are just being born in outer space today. There are stars that are about to give up the ghost, as the sun is going to do in about 5 billion years. There are stars that are so faint you could hardly see them were they even in our own planetary system. There are stars so bright you could see them with the naked eye 6,000 light years away. Light year is sort of the popular distance unit that's used in astronomy. It's the distance light will travel in a year, 31 million seconds in a year, and light goes at 186,000 miles per second. So that gives you a distance to a light year of about 6 trillion miles, the nearest star, 4 light years away. We see it as it was 4 years ago. We see the most distant star with the naked eye as it was 6,000 years ago. We see them at all different times. This tends to bother some people, but it doesn't bother astronomers because the now of life is when we see the light. I don't see you as you are right now. I see you as you were a few billionths of a second ago, and that doesn't bother any of us. Our now, our present, is as the light gets to us. So dismiss that idea. Don't even worry about the light travel time at this point. The most luminous stars, the one you can see 6,000 light years off, has a luminosity 6 million times that of the sun. The range is absolutely spectacular. This comes about because of the different masses of the stars. The lowest mass that can sustain nuclear reactions is about 8% that of the sun. Below that, they kind of fuss along with a little nuclear, but a few nuclear processes inside, but mostly they shine off their gravity. They're called brown dwarfs, and we're just really beginning to study them. They're so faint, we've only really turned them up in the last decade or so. At the high end, we have stars around 100 times the mass of the sun. This is the one we can see about 6,000 light years away. The last lecture of this series will be on the Milky Way, this band of light around the sky. The Milky Way is the primary manifestation of our galaxy. We live in a galaxy of somewhere around 200 billion stars. It's sort of a flat pancake, and we're out toward the outer edge, and when we look out into the nighttime sky, we can see this band of light around the sky that's the combined light of the 200 billion stars that are our more or less immediate neighbors. If you look at the Milky Way, you see dark splotches in it, rifts, great deal of structure. About 20% or so of the mass of our galaxy is in interstellar space. It's in the space between the stars. It's a very chaotic place with blobs of gas and dust, condensations of the gas. So dark that the natives of South America actually made constellations of some of these dark splotches. Here and there we'll find huge clouds which can begin to contract under the force of their own gravity. And as the blobs get smaller and smaller and smaller and denser, they begin to heat up and begin to turn into stars. The stuff that doesn't fall into the star spins out into a disk around it, and it's from these spinning disks that the planets begin to be born. We actually see this happening in outer space, and this is what happened to our sun 4.5 billion years ago. And for that reason, we think that a great fraction of the stars have planetary systems. We've actually found somewhere around 200 planets and around exoplanets, extrasolar planets in orbit around other stars. So there's nothing particularly unique about us. There may even be other Earths, although we can't actually see them yet. But we know where the stars come from, and we know where they're going to go. They're coming from interstellar space, as the sun was born 4.5 billion years ago, and we can actually watch the process taking place right now in front of us. What the sun would actually like to do, at least the core of the sun, is to shrink down to a point under the force of its own gravity. It can't do that because of the nuclear reactions, which support the sun and provide the stability that allows life on Earth. But eventually, all those nuclear reactions are going to stop. When all the hydrogen runs out and the sun has a helium core, the core of the sun will then shrink. And you'd think the sun might at this point dim out, but the exact opposite actually happens, because when the hydrogen runs out, the shrinkage of the core becomes very, very rapid. We begin to use a little bit of gravitational energy. That fires up more hydrogen around the ancient core, and the sun will actually get brighter. As it brightens, it expands. As it expands, it cools at the surface. And if we could watch over the next billion years after that hydrogen runs out, we would begin to see the sun turn into what we call a giant star. The surface would become reddish. We have a red giant star, and the sun will actually brighten to about 1,000 times its current luminosity, destroying everything on Earth. It's okay. It's 5 billion years off, so we need not worry about it very much. As the core shrinks, it heats up, and the helium, which was the ash of the old reaction, will begin to fuse into carbon, and that will restabilize the sun. It will shrink a little bit, and it will fuse its helium into carbon over the next billion or so years, If there's any life left on Earth, which is unlikely, we can watch the sun rise huge in the sky. You could dozens of times bigger than it is now. Eventually, the helium is going to be used all up, and the same thing will happen all over again, and the sun will re-expand and become an even bigger red giant. 6,000 or so times brighter than it is now. And if it didn't do us in the first time, it will sure do us in the second time. The remarkable thing is you can see this sort of thing happening in the other stars. Go on out and look for the red giants in the sky. All the red stars you see are either red giants or red supergiants, which are coming from even larger stars. The most massive turn into stars that expand past the orbit of the Earth, past the orbit of Mars, even past the orbit of Jupiter. Huge things. As the sun expands for the second time, it'll begin to lose its mass. In fact, it will lose all of its outer envelope, and all that will be left is the old carbon cinder at the core, which we'll now call a cooling white dwarf, about the size of the Earth. They're all over the sky. We can see all of these cinders. We can see all of the different stages of evolution. We string them together with a theory that was developed in the 20th century. So we know what's going to happen with the sun. We know what's going to happen with these stars, even though we can't actually see a given star go through its entire life cycle. The most massive stars, the really big ones, those more than about 10 times the mass of the sun, birth mass of the sun, can go beyond the fusion of helium into carbon. They can fuse carbon into neon and magnesium. They can fuse the neon and magnesium into silicon. They can fuse the silicon into iron. And iron is a funny chemical element. If you look at its nucleus made of protons and neutrons, it's as tightly packed as possible, and we can't squeeze any more energy out of it. So iron is the end of the fusion line. And once a star develops an iron core, which can happen only with the most massive of stars, the iron core teeters on the brink for a few seconds as soon as it's made and catastrophically collapses. All of the protons, the positively charged particles, and all these neutrons get packed into what is called a neutron star, about the size of a small city. And the rebound from this tremendous collapse blows the rest of the star to smithereens. And in the process, the nuclear reactions that take place in the cauldron of the exploded star produce all the chemical elements that we have in the universe, outside from the hydrogen and helium that were created in the initial event that made our universe, the Big Bang. We have a supernova. They occur about once a century in our galaxy. And our Earth, made of the heavy stuff, not much hydrogen and helium here, is the compacted debris of all the supernovae that took place in the billions of years before the creation of the Earth. We look out into space, and we see other galaxies as well. The farther away we look, the more of them there are. Hubble Space Telescope took a deep picture of a tiny dot. Pretend you can see a laser dot on a distant wall. It's about the size of the field of view, and within that dot they saw thousands of galaxies. If you replicate the number that they see around the sky, they're perhaps closing in on a trillion that can be seen from the Earth, each one with hundreds of billions of stars. All expanding away from us, moving away in this gigantic expanding universe of ours. It's been doing so for the last 13.5 billion years since it was born, in an event called the Big Bang, which we don't understand very well. Our sun came along 8 billion years thereafter. 5 billion years later, we're here on Earth, looking out at the nighttime sky, looking at the neighboring stars that make these beautiful patterns called our constellations, that bring the people out to look, interest the kids, fascinate the kids, some of whom may turn into astronomers at a later time, and can go back out and study the nighttime sky and the reality of the stars. At this point, let's leave the reality of the stars and go back and look at the patterns that they make, that the ancients appreciated and gave to us, and that we still admire, and that will probably still be admired hundreds of years from now.
This ends Lecture 1.